Okay. We had a bit of a technical glitch with our next presentation. Susan Petroni had to have knee surgery, and so she was medically advised not to travel, and she can't be with us here today. We worked quite a lot to get her presentation as close to being here as we could without being here. And there's a little bit of technology involved, but I'm going to see if I can get it to run. So let me introduce the speaker. Susan Petroni is the Senior Program Officer at the Summit Foundation in Washington, D.C., where she manages the foundation's Global Population and Youth Leadership Program. Suzanne serves as the chair for the Board of Directors of the Funders Network on Population, Reproductive Health, and Rights, a network of over 50 grantmakers that address issues of population, reproductive health, and reproductive rights, both domestically and internationally. She also co-founded and chairs the International Donor Group on Adolescent Sexual and Reproductive Health. Susan's presentation today is going to be, I've seen it, and it's a thought-provoking presentation that has to do with Goal 7, environmental sustainability. So let me see if I can get this to go here.
Good morning, everyone. I'm so sorry not to be able to be there with you all. I had knee surgery and the doctor won't let me fly, but I do hope that you'll find this presentation just as fascinating as if I were in the room with you. Good morning, everyone. And I'm so sorry not to be able to be there with you all. I had knee surgery and the doctor won't let me fly, but I do hope that you'll find this presentation just as fascinating as if I were in the room with you. No relationships to disclose, though I should say that the research for this presentation was undertaken as part of my PhD work at the George Washington University. Let's launch right in. There seems to be a budding sentiment out there that the world's current attention to climate change provides an opportunity to get population back on the global agenda. The idea is that by linking global population growth with climate change, family planning will be seen as a matter of urgent national and environmental security, and governments will support it. At the same time, there are many, including myself, who are concerned that prioritizing, maybe even overstating the environmental impacts of global population growth will endanger the global consensus that individual rights are what matter most in fostering just and sustainable development. This is what I'll be talking about in the next few minutes. I'll start with a very brief background on how population has been addressed over time and summarize the science regarding the connection between population growth and climate change. I'll then address some of the ethical issues involved in advancing an advocacy argument around family planning as a way to mitigate climate change. Finally, I'll make some suggestions for how advocates might frame these connections in a just and ethical manner. From Thomas Malthus in the 1790s to Paul Ehrlich and Garrett Hardin in the 1960s, various demographers and ecologists have raised concerns about the ability of the planet to sustain exponentially increasing human populations. For these men, achieving the end result of a healthy planet meant that the means, restrictions on reproductive freedom, were both acceptable and ethically sound. But pessimistic neo-Malthusian thinkers haven't been the only ones concerned with population growth. Economists, philanthropists, and military leaders, as well as a few women's rights activists, recognizing the potential for population growth to impact negatively on economic development and political security, were influential in the decision by the U.S. government in the 1960s to fund family planning as a way to slow population growth, both domestically and internationally. For decades, many of the programs supported by the U.S. and others were geared toward demographic targets. As a result, top-down efforts to reduce fertility, including through community-level numeric targets and sometimes coercive abortions and sterilizations, were somewhat commonplace. Even where compulsory tactics did not exist, insistence on meeting the family planning targets, as Amartya Sen has noted, often led to demands that were not fully consistent with the value of freedom. At the 1994 International Conference on Population and Development, or ICPD, the focus on family planning and population programs was overtaken by a more comprehensive and rights-based notion of reproductive health, an approach that included not only family planning, but maternal and infant health, prevention of gender-based violence, and the prevention and treatment of sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. Feminists and human rights activists played a key role in forging a consensus with environmentalists at the ICPD, agreeing that individuals and couples who had the information and means with which to plan their families would likely choose to have smaller families, in turn leading to more sustainable development. 179 countries joined the ICPD consensus, agreeing that they had a collective duty to respect and promote the right of their populations to decide their own reproductive outcomes, to improve their health and well-being, and to distribute such well-being more equitably among the world's many inhabitants. Key to this equitable distribution was a promise of funding from developed countries for programs in the less developed nations. But while family planning assistance from the United States continues to be the highest in the world, U.S. funding has remained level in real terms in recent years. Advocates have used many arguments to get the U.S. to meet the commitments it made at the ICPD to no avail. And so comes climate change, possibly, some say, the grand solution to our problems. If only we argue that climate change cannot be resolved without stemming global population growth, funding for family planning will be secured. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. Let's talk about this a bit more concretely. I'm not a climate scientist, nor am I a demographer. My research has focused more on the ethics and the political aspects of this issue, but I do understand the basics. The basics start with the general agreement that climate change is driven mainly by greenhouse gas emissions, economic growth that fuels energy consumption, and population growth that fosters increased greenhouse gas emitting activities. Imposing strategies to mitigate climate change, efforts have been geared primarily toward the first driver, specifically reducing energy consumption and developing technologies to lessen emissions. The idea of restraints on the second contributing factor, economic growth, is far from conjecturable in a world where one-third of the population lives on less than $2 a day. As to population growth, there has been relatively little scientific attention. While the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, includes population growth trends in its scenarios, and while it discusses population growth, density, distribution, and movements in looking at adaptation strategies, it has made only scant reference to slowing population growth as a means of alleviating climate change. We don't actually know a lot. Well, let's consider what we do know. In 1960, there were 3 billion people living on the planet. There are now over 6.7 billion, and we're expected to grow to somewhere between roughly 8 and 11 billion by the year 2050. Over 95% of this growth will take place in the developing world. And we have seen that over time, as population increases, so too do CO2 emissions. But even as IPCC scientists acknowledge, while the trend lines run roughly in parallel, the science is far from clear on the connection. This slide from climate scientist Brian O'Neill shows that the IPCC's future scenarios vary greatly depending on a number of factors, such that, for example, the world's population could stabilize, but if high consumption and emissions continue, we could still face significant climate change. So while the science is still out, is there room for an ethical argument to promote voluntary family planning as a way to mitigate climate change? Well, while consumption is still the primary driver of climate change, it does appear evident that population growth is at least a contributing factor. If population growth via climate change is proven to be destructive to public health and the natural environment, then governments have an obligation to intervene to lessen this damage. Even despite the uncertain science, the precautionary principle would have us engage in preventive action now to avert greater environmental damage in the future. But such a principle must not be followed in isolation from other values. So to the extent that ethically acceptable advocacy arguments are available, they should be prioritized. For example, the United States has committed to support voluntary family planning at higher funding levels, but it's not meeting these commitments. Partly as a result, over 100 million women in the developing world want but don't have access to modern methods of family planning. As a way to address this need, perhaps advocates are ethically justified in using the climate change connection to hold the U.S. to its duty to keep its promises. However, having studied the evolution of U.S. international family planning policy, I can tell you that promises and obligations have, for over 2 decades now, not been the most significant influences around these policies. The religious right has. And they already accuse family planning advocates of population control, So making the climate change connection by focusing on demographics rather than individual choice might just feed right into their arguments. One could argue that making the population climate change connection can help make the public aware of the duty it has to leave the planet in a sustainable condition for future generations. If future persons matter, then we must consider their well-being in our actions today. Further, to the extent that discussions about the impacts of population on the environment can help to raise awareness about the role of the U.S. in the world, perhaps a more comprehensive and ethically appropriate range of solutions can be addressed. But articulating a close relationship between population growth and greenhouse gas emissions poses the prospect of countries which are under pressure to reduce their emissions to consider a simple solution, reducing their rates of population growth. And if done without regard for individual rights, such policies could turn coercive and prove devastating to human rights and well-being, all in the name of environmental stewardship. China has already made this connection. At a UN meeting on climate change last year, China announced that its one-child policy, by prohibiting 300 million births from taking place, had reduced the country's CO2 emissions by 1.3 billion tons. More subtly, perhaps, making this argument could encourage individuals in this country to blame, wrongly, population growth in the developing world for the problem of climate change. Let's think about this. The United States contains 4% of the world's population, but produces some 22% of its greenhouse gases. The average American emitted 20.2 metric tons of CO2 in 2005. That is some 13 to 25 times the emissions of the typical Indian, Indonesian, Yemeni, or Nigerian, and 73 times that of the average Bangladeshi. Even as these countries grow in the coming years, they have a long way to go to catch the U.S. in total emissions. This is a graphic representation of our current emissions as compared to these other countries. So what about future growth? Well, while we worry about the growth of other countries, the U.S. population is expected to grow by about 140 million in the next 40 years. While this is far fewer people than India will add, it's roughly the same as Nigeria expects to contribute more than Pakistan, and more than twice as much as either Bangladesh or Indonesia. So where will that put us in the future? The United States is expected in the year 2030 to produce more CO2 than the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and India combined. Only China's emissions will exceed those of the U.S. And does anyone want to suggest family planning as a solution to the Chinese government? Given that the U.S. population increase will have significantly disproportionate negative impacts on our climate, we could not ethically consider engaging in a debate about the need to slow population growth in the rest of the world without addressing our own growth rates first. And I would offer, frankly, that the family planning community is unprepared to take on the discussion of immigration that will inevitably arise if we begin down this path. Unless our own production and consumption patterns change dramatically, we will long continue to be the world's greatest emitter of greenhouse gases, or second greatest, even as our share of the world's population declines. So I would argue that it would be highly unethical to enable the transference of responsibility to the world's poorest people for a problem toward which the United States has been and will continue to be the primary contributor. Lastly, a renewed debate about the impacts of global population growth may disrupt the hard-earned consensus around government-supported family planning. The risk of alienating feminists, human rights advocates, and others is very real if advocacy arguments are not tendered cautiously. I'd rather like to end right here, but it seems inevitable that the connections between climate change and population growth will be made, and they may be made by those who don't start with a rights-based approach. So let me offer a few final thoughts. Generating support among American public and policymakers for government-supported voluntary family planning at home and abroad is an important task. It's something that's desired by many women and for which sufficient funding and policies do not currently exist. But as we promote greater investments, we must demand that policies prioritize freedom and that they be made with individuals at the core, because in the end, it is individuals, not abstract millions, with whom we share the planet. Placing primacy on freedom means, first and foremost, allowing individuals to decide the number and the timing of their children, which we must recognize may be a decision to have large numbers of children. Further, as the ICPD affirmed, family planning should not be supported in isolation, but must be enveloped in comprehensive policies of sustainable development. Indeed, enhancing social development, as well as promoting gender equity and enabling individual responsibility, can contribute to the outcomes we all want, improve quality of life, and a healthy planet that can be sustained for generations to come. These policies start with the individual, but they require the commitment of the global community. For the United States, this necessitates an understanding of our duty to aid, namely our obligation to help others to achieve at least a reasonable minimum quality of life. In meeting this duty, not only will we contribute to improving the health and well-being of millions of women, men, and youth today, but so too will we ultimately contribute to slowing population growth and its impacts on the environment. Moving the discussion forward in a just manner also requires emphasizing first and foremost a responsibility on the part of Americans to mitigate the harm that we ourselves are doing to the global environment. If we take seriously a duty to leave a healthy planet for future generations, and if we wish to be a credible voice for solving the challenge of climate change, we must give primacy to reducing our own country's production of emissions. And if we are to engage in a discussion of the connections between population growth and climate change, we must acknowledge that slower population growth would likely only play a limited role in solving the climate change problem. Lastly, we must start at home. We would do great harm to the notion of justice if we were to claim for our nation a right to grow as large as it may, while we direct our rhetoric about unsustainable growth toward countries which contribute comparatively mere specks of greenhouse gases into our shared air. A thoughtful and deliberative dialogue can help Americans to better understand the significant role that the United States plays in the world, not solely as a consumer and polluter, but as an important member of a global commons, and yes, as a beneficent donor. If embarking upon such a discussion leads to greater support for U.S. contributions in this area, it will achieve a great deal of good. Thank you all for your patience through this presentation, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
All right, so Suzanne's not here to take questions, and we're pretty much out of time, so let me just spend a minute to close up the session. If people do have something that they'd like to take up with Suzanne, there's her email address and her phone number, and I'm sure she'd be happy to hear from you. First, let me start by thanking our panel of experts who came to talk with us today. I think that all of the presentations were really very high quality. I hope that people got some sense of what the public health case for family planning as an intervention is and how it might help us to improve the global development agenda. I appreciate Karen's thoughtful review of the situation with family planning and HIV, in particular the review of the PEPFAR Global Fund initiatives and her insight on the need for us to explicitly support family planning in its own right, in addition to supporting family planning as integrated with the HIV efforts. As always, I appreciate Duff's insight and insider views on the making of family planning policy. It was great to hear about his the advocacy initiatives of the former directors of USAID's population efforts. And as somebody who does a lot of research utilization, I was struck by the how much their strategy and tactics are a social networking approach, a multidimensional design that takes advantage of a lot of the behavioral theory that underlies research utilization efforts. I appreciate Susanna's status on the funding of population efforts, her insights on some of the emerging issues in funding, and her insights on how to look forward in research and advocacy. And like I say, I think that, there's a lot of talk these days about environmental sustainability and population, and I think that Suzanne has a lot of things for us to think about. Thank you all for coming, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Amazing.
Well, first we have to do it like YouTube, you know.
We have somebody on the staff.